This is Brand and New from the International Trademark Association. This podcast series explores changes and dynamics in the legal world, now and tomorrow, with a focus on intellectual property.
Thanks to OneWed IP for being the sponsor of this episode of Brand and New.
Welcome to Brand and New. I am Audrey Dove. These last few months, public authorities warned citizens about the alarming increase in the lethality and availability of fake prescription pills. These counterfeit drugs are mass-produced by criminal drug networks in labs, deceptively marked as legitimate pills, and sometimes even killing and suspecting or vulnerable individuals. Fueled by easy internet sales, global supply routes, and minimal effective punishments, counterfeit prescription drugs have become an exploding industry worth over $75 billion a year worldwide, and at the same time, a massive economic, social, and public health issue. This trend has been reinforced by the COVID-19 pandemic, which fueled the global demand for medical supplies and medications. But what is the reality of this underground market at the global scale? How big of a threat are fake medications? What are the impacts from an economic but also a social and healthcare perspectives? What is the role of international organizations such as Interpol, whose main missions focus on fighting criminal acts? Our guest today is Rory Corcoran, who is an assistant director with the Illicit Markets Subdirectorate within the Organized and Emerging Crime Directorate General at Interpol, the global network of police forces representing 194 member countries, making it the world's largest police organization, sharing data on crimes and criminals. Rory joined Interpol 3 years ago and is now responsible for overseeing several of its organized crimes programs, including environmental security and illicit goods and global health. Most recently, he has been in charge of leading Interpol's worldwide fight against COVID-related crime. Rory has over 30 years of experience in law enforcement, having served the majority of his career in the Irish Counterterrorism Unit and the Irish National Economic Crime Bureau. Rory, thank you so much for accepting our invitation and welcome to Brand and New.
Thank you very much, Audrey. It's my pleasure.
So contrary to luxury goods available in local markets, auto parts distributed through mom-and-pop shops, or even more generally retail products available on global e-commerce platforms, most of us may not have encountered counterfeiting drugs in their daily life, at least knowingly. Based on your experience with Interpol, but also with the Irish Garda, could you give us an overview of the market of fake medications?
Yes, Audrey. And as a global organization, police organization like Interpol, this is where we have very strong capabilities because we run a number of global operations yearly and targeted regional operations to get a better understanding of the threat when we talk about fake and falsified medicines. So Operation Pangea would be our trademark operation. And over the years, we have seen a transition in relation to the different products that counterfeiters seem to focus on to make money, obviously. In 2018, for example, in Operation Pangea, we've seen a stark rise in anti-inflammatory products and painkillers. Then in 2019, we looked more at illicit medicines where erectile dysfunction medicines and benzodiazepines were really a strong focus, and we had a lot of seizures in that area. In 2020, of course, the whole global landscape changed because we had a global pandemic. And this health pandemic, of course, created huge opportunities for criminals because the demand for medicines was huge. So we also looked at the area of personal protective equipment. There was a huge demand for these type of products, and counterfeiters were ready to adapt to the global pandemic and change their criminal behavior and their business model to meet that demand coming from countries, whether legitimate customers or customers that were willing to buy fake medicines. We've seen this huge increase in a particular medicine called ivermectin, which is used to treat parasites in humans and animals. But contrary to the message that was being sent out on social media platforms, this was not a remedy or a cure for COVID-19, but there was a huge demand for it. We had a number of seizures around the world. But what we do with that information is we understand the global threat, because to tackle it, we first have to understand it. And that's why we collect the information. And then we formulate and draft a type of operational response with our member countries. And that's why a global perspective is hugely important. We have different regions in the world where demand may be different, but the demand for medicines has never been as high. We are monitoring the threat landscape. We are working with all sectors to try and address it, including the private sector, the customs sector, the e-commerce platforms, because now the threat has never been as high. And it will remain that way, we see it, for the foreseeable future, because we are still in the midst of a global pandemic. Although we are in some ways seeing the light, this threat remains very live and real.
How has your transition from a policing role at the national level in Ireland to the international level with Interpol affected your own understanding of the fake drug black market and its challenges from an enforcement perspective?
Yeah, and a really relevant question, because although I had some experience of international policing in my role in Ireland, to come to Interpol and to have that exposure to 194 countries and have, I wouldn't say thrown in at the deep end, but you learn to adapt very quickly to that international environment, because you have to. So when we look at organized crime is a global problem. It can't be treated or addressed at a national or regional level. It is purely global. Criminals don't respect borders, and that's why Interpol, with our secure I-24/7 platform, we can exchange information very quickly with 194 countries, either to arrest a fugitive, to address a particular crime problem, or to act on information that is very relevant and timely and needs a response from law enforcement. And we get that information to the relevant National Central Bureau in that country to be acted upon by law enforcement. That to me is a huge change in the way I work, but I see the benefits of how Interpol can cooperate with countries, can assist countries. And that benefit is really realized when we see the outcomes of some of our operations, particularly when we look at the area of fake medicines, falsified medicines, and IP crime in general, because counterfeiting now is the number one most lucrative crime area in the world. And of course, this will attract a lot of criminal activity because we look at the low risk, high reward factor, and that is hugely important. So what we try to do is home in on some of these people, international bad actors, raise the risk for them of being caught during some of our activities, ensure that whatever information we collect in relation to these people gets to the right law enforcement agencies in a timely manner for action. So in short, in answer to your question, it's very difficult to compare national policing to international policing, but unless we have cooperation on a national and regional level, the international frameworks will not work.
The cost of fake medicines is estimated at over $75 billion per year. Beyond the economic loss for pharmaceuticals, but also from a tax perspective, counterfeit drugs also trigger major risks from a public health perspective, of course. For instance, in the US, fake drugs have fueled the opioid crisis that kills over 50,000 persons each year. They represent a critical risk for consumers because of their composition, their dosage, deceitful presentation or labeling. Are these risks affecting all Interpol member states equally, or are certain regions more vulnerable than others?
On an international level, without pointing the finger, it is very obvious of where this threat is emerging from when we talk about counterfeit goods in general. When we talk about medicines and falsified medicines, there are a number of countries and regions which are very prominent in that regard in the manufacture and distribution of these type of illegal products. But then we look at the risks involved for vulnerable people who buy these products either in a legitimate way, hoping that this product will either address a particular illness that they have. And then we see the impact of that. We see hundreds of thousands of children die in Africa. As you mentioned, you see in the US, up to 50,000 people die per year. I mean, we're talking about criminals with a complete disregard to people's health and safety, and are willing to let people die as a result of selling these products. And now that this market has gone online, it is difficult because to detect these people and these products, and that's why working with the private sector is very important. But to answer your question in relation to countries and regions, we could be pretty specific and say the African continent would be particularly vulnerable because a lot of the medicines that are sold there would be sold in street markets, and it's difficult to verify the authenticity of these products. Whereas in the more developed countries, we would have health authorities that could verify whether these products are legitimate or fake. But yes, the threat is different as you move around the world, but criminals are the people who exploit that. They're the people who know and do, they research, they share information very freely with each other. They know the areas to target. They know where law enforcement is possibly weaker, laws are weaker, and government action is probably not as strong in some areas where some of these medicines are being manufactured, and there is no oversight in relation to some of these factories and people that are distributing it.
Since this is your country of origin, but also where you develop your expertise in organized crime, what can Ireland, as a case study, teach us from that perspective?
Well, I'm very happy to say that Ireland have been very strong in the area of tackling falsified medicines, fake medicines, and in general, counterfeit products. Coming from a terrorism background myself, I've seen the development of this crime area and how criminals and terrorists were exploiting counterfeit goods to fund a terrorist campaign that lasted a number of decades in Ireland. We possibly didn't really understand that threat. We were more focused on saving lives and counteracting the activities of a terrorist group. We possibly should have focused more on how they were raising funds, because counterfeit products were hugely important to them, and contraband products such as cigarettes, falsified medicines, counterfeit clothes and goods were raising funds in the background for these people. So on a national level, we became very aware of that towards the end of the threat that terrorists posed in our country, and we addressed it. But moving forward, I think it's very important that other countries understand that people are raising huge amounts of money from this type of criminality, and it is funding other types of crime, more serious organized crime and terrorism. So it's important that we focus on the money element. And that's what we did in Ireland. We tackled this from a money laundering perspective. And during the pandemic, we issued a purple notice where we actually helped the Irish authorities arrest a number of people who were in possession of falsified medicines, and over $500,000 in cash as well. So when we see that type of money involved with these products, it's important that we focus on the money element. We use money laundering legislation to tackle it and really understand the business model of these people, because this money has to enter the legitimate banking system at some stage. And this is where we can work very closely with our financial intelligence units to tackle it.
Thanks to One With IP for being the sponsor of this episode of Brain & You.
Can you please present us the role of Interpol in the fight against fake drugs in particular, and what's Interpol's strategy?
Obviously, we have to tailor our activities based on the way we see the threat landscape. Interpol is a big organization, 194 countries. We maintain a lot of data here, but it's very important that that data is understood and that we disseminate that data to the right people to take action and not let it lie within our databases where at some stage it becomes irrelevant and outdated. As I said, as part of our Operation Pangea, for example, which is our global operation, our annual operation, last year we focused on a particular element of working with the private sector. We achieved that. In the Philippines, we managed to assist the country there to arrest an individual who was involved in selling large amounts of fake medicines online. He was also involved in the manufacturing and distribution. And we worked with e-commerce platforms. We worked with the pharmaceutical companies to, first of all, identify the target. And then we facilitated the exchange of information from the private sector to those law enforcement agencies to be actioned. And I think that's really important as we move forward as an organization. For me, when I look at the whole holistic view of counterfeit goods and the response from law enforcement, I see law enforcement as the answer and I see them as the problem, because in a lot of countries, it's not a priority. But when we do get that traction from law enforcement, we actually are very effective. So moving forward, I think for Interpol, it's very important that if the private sector invests so much money in protecting their products, and identifying where these products are being manufactured, how these supply chains are actually operating, that we get access to that data and we ensure that that data is provided to law enforcement for timely action. So Interpol, a very strong organization, but we need the support and we need data from a number of sources in order to effectively address the threat of counterfeiting in general.
When discussing public health issues, we think of the global pandemic of the last 18 plus months. With demand for personal protection equipment and hygiene products growing exponentially, criminals have found new ways to profit by selling substandard or counterfeit items such as surgical masks, PCR tests, or even outright fake coronavirus treatments. Can you tell us more about how COVID-19 has turned into an opportunity for criminals involved in the fake drug market? And we also understand that Interpol has been very active to address those risks, to give more color to Interpol's actions. Could you give us more details about the strategy and the logistics of the recent operation Pangea 14, led by Interpol with the support of local police, customs and health regulatory authorities of 92 countries against the sale of fake and illicit medicines and medical products?
Yes, and it's important that although we mentioned Pangea, and I just maybe go back a little bit to the start of the pandemic period, where we invoked Operation Vigilant Interdiction, which is Operation VI. We engaged very early with the vaccine manufacturers and the manufacturers of PPEs as well, and in a very formal way, because, I mean, although we have different restrictions in sharing data, a global pandemic very quickly can expose all our capabilities. So it's important that we engage with the right stakeholders very early. So as part of the preparation for Pangea had just finished back in 2020, and we were looking really at how we could improve our response to the area of the sale of counterfeit medicines online, and also the emerging threat when we look at the vaccine rollout. So we also had Pangea in the planning stage, and then we had Operation VI. Now, Operation VI brought together a number of countries. We targeted countries where we seen that the threat was more imminent, and we looked at sharing information very quickly. As a result of that, we published a lot of notices. We did a threat assessment. We shared that with the World Health Organization, World Customs Organization, and Europol. We also published a number of orange and purple notices. For those of you who are not aware, our purple notices is when we identify a new modus operandi, we get that information out very quickly to countries. And our orange notices when we see an imminent threat. So we did see an imminent threat in relation to vaccines. We've seen on the dark net that people were selling vaccines, obviously looking for money in return. And we also seen websites and social media trying to convince people that vaccines were actually for sale online. And we did a number of awareness campaigns. As a direct result of one of those notices in particular, we became aware of a consignment of fake masks that was moving in the Asian region towards Africa. We alerted our national central bureaus, and we were able to help that country to intercept that consignment. And within that consignment, we found a large number of counterfeit vaccines. Following assessment and assistance from a private sector, we verified that they were fake. But we shared that information with our colleagues in China. And as a result of that, there was over 80 people arrested in two continents and over 2 million euros seized in assets. So, I mean, you look at the distribution, and the whole supply chain was disrupted at a very high level. This was a very sophisticated and organized group of individuals who were willing to put people's lives at risk to make money. But thankfully, our systems worked, our cooperation worked. And that really gave us a great launching board then for Operation Pangea, where we've seen that the engagement of the private sector, which, you know, we have to give acknowledgement here, it was the private sector that gave us that information. So, I mean, we looked really then to build that cooperation. And for Pangea next year, the private sector cooperation would be a huge focus of that. And I think that moving forward, I think both sectors working together would be very important. But just maybe to go back on how the pandemic situation has progressed, we've seen science trying to keep pace with the pandemic. We've seen criminals very quickly adapting to the pandemic. And the demand was so huge that a lot of people were fooled and duped into buying counterfeit goods, and of course, with no possible chance of reimbursement or recourse. We would try and collect that information to try and identify some of the bad actors behind it. But really, as I say, moving forward, this private public sector engagement is hugely important for us.
Interpol has developed tools and guidance for consumers and patients to be more educated and skeptical when it comes to medications. What advice would you give to our listeners when in doubt as to whether one drug is legitimate or not? What to watch for to avoid being scammed? And I have in mind the famous six P's of Interpol: place, prescriptions, promises, price, privacy, and product.
For us, the way criminals operate now, they're very sophisticated, they're very smart. So, I mean, they'll try their best to fool you. It's important that we mention that Interpol can't verify whether a website is legitimate or fake. This is really something that needs to be done on a national level, where people, if it seems too good to be true, if the website, look at the spelling, look at the products themselves, look at the labeling. Sometimes there can be very obvious mistakes. But if you're in doubt whether a website is legitimate or not, you should, first of all, you should be buying from proper retailers within your country. And the sale of medicines online is always risky. So you should be going to your local pharmacist or whatever retailer in your country that distributes those type of medicines. But if you're in doubt, and not every country has this luxury, but you should be contacting your local health authority and they can help verify whether this website is legitimate or not. But when it comes to the likes of the African continent and some other continents around the world, the sale of medicines and marketplaces is very, very difficult to verify. And people really are in a very high risk area there when you're buying medicines from those people, because there is a strong possibility that those medicines are falsified. There's a strong possibility that they may make you sicker than you actually are. So in short, really try to verify the seller. If it seems too good to be true, it probably is. And don't take risks with your health. If you're going to buy a product, IP law and copyright law is not just there to protect companies. It's there to protect the public. I mean, if somebody goes into a retailer and wants to buy something, they're entitled to have a legitimate product. So those laws are there to protect you as much as they are there to protect the brand owner.
Rory, we started our conversation with a description of the current landscape of the fake drug market. But what are the trends or new circumstances that Interpol foresees for the near future when it comes to the distribution of fake medications and the fight against it? Are there, for instance, new distribution networks, crime patterns, new target consumers, maybe new enforcement mechanisms?
We see the online space now becoming hugely important for us. During Operation Pangea last year, we took down over 100,000 websites, which was more than we had done in the last 10 years. So this is where we've seen a lot more activity. During the pandemic, of course, when people were confined, they couldn't be out and about, shops were closed. So it was an obvious shift in trend that this was going to happen. So we've very much focused on that and will focus on it in the future. I think that when we look at the emerging trends of medicines, I think that now more than ever, the demand is huge. So this is where criminals will exploit it. But we have to look at the area of vaccines. Vaccines, I don't think we have fully realized the threat in relation to COVID-19, because a lot of these products now are going to become off-the-shelf products, whether that's to address the symptoms of COVID-19 or some type of vaccine-related product that can be bought on the shelf. When that happens, of course, counterfeiters are going to move into that space very quickly. They're going to try and counterfeit these products and sell them online or sell them at a cheaper rate. And again, I reinforce my earlier point, if it seems too good to be true, it usually is. Go to your legitimate retailers and make sure that you're buying a product that's fit for purpose. But what we're hoping to do at Interpol, and we're in the planning stages of it now, is building that stronger cooperation and a more sustainable model of cooperation with the private sector, so we can get that information out to law enforcement very quickly, show them the legitimate products, so when they do come across suspected fake products, that they can compare that to what we are actually providing to them. And we are doing that as we speak with the private sector. We're also looking at the area of empty vaccine vials, where maybe some countries are a little bit complacent in relation to how they actually discard them. And criminals will use the empty vials, fill them with some type of solution, and try and sell them in the legitimate markets. So the landscape is changing all the time. But the good thing about it is we're working very closely with the private sector to monitor it. We also have established Interpol's Global Financial Crime Task Force, which I am the operational lead for. And within the scope of that task force, we're very much targeting the areas of fraud as well. And criminals targeting government agencies and health authorities, trying to dupe them into selling large amounts of vaccines. And we're working with the private sector to try and address that. It is an area of cyber-enabled fraud that we have to be very aware of. All crime now has a cyber element to it. So Interpol are very much prepared for the threat, constantly monitoring it. But again, working with our member countries. And this is where I think we are extremely grateful to those countries for the cooperation we do get to address the threat.
I have now two rapid-fire questions for you. A word that would summarize this year and the one you expect for 2022.
Be aware. I think it's two words, but I think we still have to be vigilant. We're not out of the woods yet when we talk about the pandemic. And the threat is real when we talk about fake medicines and falsified medicines. So be aware is the two words that I would summarize that period.
And the last book you have read.
I was a keen rugby player when I was younger. I tend to read a lot of books about sport. Maybe not to name specifically the book, but it's usually centered around Irish rugby and Irish rugby players. I like to... Keith Earls has released a book recently, which I'm in the process of reading. So that's I tend to focus on sporting books.
Thank you very much, Rory.
Thank you, Audrey.
My guest today was Rory Corcoran, responsible for overseeing Interpol's several organized crimes programs, including environmental security and illicit goods and global health.
I am now pleased to welcome Sam Lee, partner and member of the management committee of One With IP. He practices in the different areas of intellectual property law with a focus on litigating patent, trade secret, and other technology-related matters. Sam, could you please share with us a few advice you give to your clients in biotech, pharmaceutical, and chemical industries to prevent infringement?
I think for multinational companies, companies who operate in China, it's important that it has a China patent strategy. But that strategy should be integrated with its global strategy. You have to treat Chinese market as an integral part of the world market in formulating the patent strategy. And on the trade secret side, the key is regulating the information flow. The information flow into China and out of China, as well as within China. It's important to strike a balance between the need of the information in China, the need to protect confidentiality, but you also need to use the information for your R&D manufacturing, sales and technical supports. Ideally, you would have one system of information management, but in the China part, which is tailored to the Chinese circumstances. For infringement, with those systems in place, I think you are ready to tackle any infringement. There's just one thing I'd like to mention is, it's very important to have a trusted relationship with a select group of outside counsels. That's your outside resource. Whenever you have infringement issues, whether you are going to be suing someone for infringement or defending for attacks of infringement, you need to respond quickly and adequately. There, it's critical that you have a trusted relationship exist so you can work smoothly. A lot of times, litigation is not only decided in the courtroom, but also decided whether you provide adequate technical and evidentiary support. Particularly as the patent litigation, trade secret litigation, both are very complex litigations. A trust relationship would ensure smooth as well as in-depth cooperation.
Any case study related to fake medications you want to talk about?
Yeah, I can talk about the issue with fake medication. It is a subject which we do deal with a lot, even though I don't necessarily personally deal with this area. It is an area where we are. Has a traditional strength. This counterfeiting medication is a serious global problem. Our practice involves investigation or giving legal services concerning trademark law, criminal law, and also coordinating technical identifications. The couple of recent cases we have all involve providing legal advice, suggesting punishment, or providing technical appraisal to the authorities. Another character in our cases is it usually involve working with authorities closely and cross regions, like not only in a particular city, but in multiple provinces, regions. Like, for example, we work with authorities in Shanghai and in Guangdong when they have the campaigns against the fake medicine. Fake medicine is a serious problem. It is a high priority for law enforcement, but they also, because it's also a very technical field, so they need a lot of support from both the companies as well as the lawyers engaged by the companies. After the administrative or criminal punishment, we pursue damage recovery for clients. We have very aggressive tactics in evidence gathering. With good evidence, we can recover meaningful damages for our client. Another matter we want to mention is we notice that in many of our cases, there is one counterfeiter. Usually they counterfeit more than one brand. So it's very important that the companies work together. A recent challenge is online, because the sales of fake medication become more and more online, even cross-border. So it become important to have good intergovernmental cooperation as well as regulate the internet platforms in disciplining counterfeit medicines.
You have been practicing IP law both in the US and in China. What are the main points of comparison, again, based on your experience?
I've been practicing law in the United States, and then I came back in 2004 and been spent about 17 years practicing in China. Many of our clients are in the pharmaceutical industry or chemical industry. There are a couple of things I notice, which is very interesting. One is over the past decade, I think the technical sophistication in patent and trade secret litigation has increased dramatically in China. It used to be fairly simple, straightforward cases, direct copies. In trade secret infringement, they make no changes. They just take whatever information and use them. And now I think the infringement become more sophisticated, and it's more like a similar product rather than just a copy of what you have. It's more like arguably design around rather than straightforward literal infringement. And that makes the litigation more complex, particularly in the last 5 years. I think the complexity has increased a lot because of procedure and evidentiary rule changes. These procedure and evidentiary rule changes enable the clients in the litigation, but it also makes the litigation itself more complex. Another feature I find is quite interesting in China is you need to pay close attention to policy changes, because the policy changes can affect the priority of how the law gets enforced and how resolution of certain issues is effected. For give you an example, it used to be that the damages are uniformly low. And even though the law has not changed a lot, but policy has changed and emphasized to provide adequate damages. So in recent years, you see an increasing number of higher damage cases. There's another observation I want to provide is on the prosecution side, because we do have both prosecution and litigation in our practice. There used to be the prosecution, particularly when we prosecute foreign application, it's more of like translate into Chinese and go through the procedures, make sure, go through the procedure timely and accurately. But now the prosecution involve more legal advice because the law become, more variety. Another is there more demand if drafting new inventions and advising clients on strategy.
Thank you, Sam.
Thank you, Audrey.
Thank you for listening to Brand and New, brought to you by the International Trademark Association. Be sure to tune in every 2 weeks on Tuesday for new episodes. If you like today's podcast, please subscribe and share it. We are always looking for new people to discover brand and new. And to learn more about INTA, its resources and events, please visit www.inta.org.